Anyone seen the air conditioner guy? tell him I'm looking for him. I usually lead a very resentful, free life till I got here this morning. Packing my bags, saying I'm going to Toronto in September. I should bring a heavy coat. Because whenever Ernie invites me, there's 16 feet of snow outside. So, anyway, my name is Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm glad to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank all of you for having me here, and Deborah and Jake for picking me up at the airport. I was looking for someone with a sign, drunks here, Peter M. And there were a lot of signs, but she found me, and she said, I was looking for Robert De Niro. You're talking to me. So I don't know if she gave me a compliment or insulted me. I don't know what, we're trying to work on that. I called home, I said, what if somebody called you Robert De Niro? Is that like a nice thing to say to me? I don't. But we found each other. It's interesting when I get to airports, what goes on. We were talking about this, she's up in her rafters there, how you can spot, we can spot each other. You kind of notice, they look like a drunk, right? So I'm in Heathrow and to do a weekend there in London, first time there. Couple of years ago, three, 4 years ago, and I get there and no one's there to pick me up. Everyone has signs, Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, no Peter the AA guy. And so about 45 minutes goes by and I don't know who to call. I said, well, I'm stuck in London. I hope they have good hotels because my committee's not here. And out of nowhere, hundreds of people, I see this guy running out of breath. I said, that's got to be a drunk. It was. And he didn't take my luggage, and he couldn't remember where he parked his car, so another 45 minutes walking through the airport trying to find his car. And we finally get in the car. This is like a 7.5-hour flight, 45 minutes waiting for him, 45 minutes trying to get the car. As soon as I get in the car, he starts sharing his deepest, innermost secrets to me. All the places I could have gone to. Anyway, I am grateful to be here. To share my experience, strength, and hope with you. I get these invitations a lot, and I'm very grateful for that. My life is one of invitation. And so when they do come to me, I pray, I look at my calendar, and God says, off you go, and I go, and I suit up and show for fun and for free, as we heard so many times in the sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go as a recovered member because this talk this morning is really just a reflection of what I do when I'm in the trenches between the last podium talk. So I come to you as a recovered member, and I say recovered because I am, and anything less than that would be falsely humble. But God in his infinite mercy took me from a place of June 23rd, 1988, when he separated me from alcohol for the last time, to where I am this morning with you. And I've been given spiritual wings to go fly and take this message and shout it from the rooftops in my home, occupations, and affair, wherever God may lead me. And I get here and on a life of invitation. And the invitation's extended to me usually through group conscience. And we commence shoulder to shoulder upon a common journey. And we get to share in this glorious message in this place called Alcoholics Anonymous, which is sacred. And if we haven't found out that the rooms of AA are sacred, I hope you stick around long enough to find out how sacred they are. Because me, like many of you, are supposed to be somewhere else on a hot Saturday morning. In jail, on a drunk, in a bar, dead. And yet we suit up and show up and come to our AA meetings, and we watch lives get reborn and resurrected in the sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? Our book talks about recreating. It uses the word reborn because that's exactly what happens to people like us when we show up and we walk through the archway of an AA meeting, the great equalizer, and people let us hand us a big book, the 12 steps, and say we have a way out for you. And so I'm grateful to be able to share a message like that. My life along with invitation is one of being mindful and present to hear. It allows me to be free. One of the great things, of the many great things I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous through the 12 steps from a loving God, has been all the fellowship, all the service I get to do, and one drunk work with another, all the group level service I get to do, because everything we get to do, and getting recovered through the big book Alcoholics Anonymous has taken me to one spot, and that is a place called stillness or silence. No longer operating with a mind-dominated life, which many of us operate on. No longer operating on the lines of human consciousness, but being moved and living along the lines of God consciousness. And that all comes from a place of stillness and silence, being unhooked or detached from this thinking mind, which is constantly moving. It's perpetual motion and permeates and infects and affects everything we come in contact with, because it's all coming out of fear. How many people drove over here alone this morning? Handful. If you think about that ride, you didn't drive over here alone. Because if you think about it, how many people were you talking to on the way over here? Why are you going to that meeting for? The guy's from the Northeast. I should go to another meeting. No, not. You better go there. Hurry spiritual. No, he isn't. I hate my job. I hate her, in fact, you know. Right, we do this stuff. Then we replay stuff from about 20 years ago, and we really get into it. 20-year-old resentment, we're really in it. We're driving to an AME, and we're really going out. We're foaming. Walk into an AME. How you doing, Joe? I'm great. Everything's good. Right. And those same 45 people are in the parking lot waiting to go home with you, right? I told you not to go to that meeting. And then they tuck us in at night. And you know how we wake up in the morning? How'd you sleep last night? I don't know. I tossed and turned because they were still talking to us. And as soon as you wake up in the morning, they're at it again. They follow you to work. And you know, it's nonstop. Compulsive, obsessive thinking. Now, that same thinking is the same thinking that takes me back to that which is killing me, which is a drink. But what thinking will do is go underground and resurface in other areas. They're called the untreated alcoholic sprees that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're living all over page 52, and the only way to remedy that is on we go on a more thinking spree, another thinking spree. We go on a little food spree. We go on a little sex spree. We go on a little anger spree. We go on a little fear spree, all coming from this thinking mind, which is fear-based and insecure. And I get to hear the world through fear. I get to talk through fear. I get to see through fear, rather than when the conversion happens, when I get to hear, see, and speak with God. Mind-dominated life. So the work has allowed me to get removed from all of that. Little by slowly brought me to a place of stillness. And I will tell you, I have a very busy life. I'm in the treatment center business, which is 400 dramas an hour. Right? Everyone has a drama. I work with a lot of new folks. That's 800 dramas an hour. Right? I do this. I'm packing into the streamlines. So I have a very busy life, but it comes from stillness. And when we come from a place of stillness, we're that much more effective and effective. We're present to the moment. Got a task, got a lot of tasks to do, but I'm here, then I move here, and then I move here, and I'm giving my attention to someone rather than waiting for you to get done so I can get out of here, or trying to think of what I'm going to say before you finish. Right? Listen to the silence between the words someone speaks. So all this work has brought me to stillness, and ain't that great? No longer being dominated by this thinking mind. For new people, anything the mind tells you until you've had the spiritual transformation, be rid of. Because none of it is good. It'll pretty up a junkyard. It'll come in the form of a relationship, more money, less money, better job, new car, no car, whatever it might be, popular sponsor, unpopular sponsor, whatever the thinking mind is telling you, dump, because it's a lie. Right? The main problem for us centers in the mind, not the body. So why am I going to entertain that and make Monday's solution to Tuesday's problem? Right? The thinking mind is a great predator, and yet we return to it and look for a solution from it, and yet it contradicts the spirit. It contradicts everything God gives us, which comes from deep down within. When there's no noise, there's no sound, and anyone's ever got that intuitive thought, you're not thinking, you're just moving. I watch little children with their moms, right? Moms don't think. They just tend to children. There's no thought involved. They just give them a baby. They know what to do. There's no figuring out. It's a great thing to watch. When you're on a 12-step call and you're moving real quick, there's no thought involved. You're just moving as God would have you be. It's a tremendous amount of freedom having consciousness without thought. When we start to think, that's when the problems start. Well, maybe I'll look bad. I'll probably look really good if I do this. Maybe I shouldn't do this. Oh, you know, it goes on and on and on. I was sharing with someone earlier, immigrations. This is the first time I come through Canada, by the way, where I didn't get stopped. I usually get stopped, and they take me in a back room, and it's a mess. But I'm on my way into security, and some woman was trying to make it up the elevator, the escalator, the steps are broken, and she had this big heavy luggage, and no one was helping her. And I lay off some here to Vegas people saying, oh no, I look like a fool if I help, oh I got other things to do, always thinking, because what you guys gave me, I says, let me help, do you need help? She said, yes. I took her to the top of the steps, and her older fellow was her husband, and he thanked me, a million thank yous. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what they do out there. You know. I had someone once tell me, you meditate to escape reality. No, I go meditate to experience reality. You're in delusion out there. Have you watched CNN lately? Let's drop bombs today. There's nothing else going on. Let's just drop some bombs and see what, you know. It's bizarre, and yet we come into AA and we walk softly and carry a big book. Ain't that great? So God separates me from alcohol for the last time, June 23rd, 1988. My separation from alcohol was not a pleasant one. It was violent. It was ugly. I wasn't looking to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, on a day of separation from booze, I wasn't even thinking about AA or doing any of these type of things or anything to do in our glorious fellowship. In fact, I wasn't even thinking about getting into my 7 treatment center. That was the last thing on my mind. In fact, it didn't even cross my mind. The only thing that entered me was this. I don't want to die. And I knew I was going to die at the hands of booze on June 23rd, 1980. It's the first time I didn't want to die. Prior to that, as Bill says in his story, I welcomed the idea. I tried getting out of this deal called life for years. And I reflected upon that in Alcoholics Anonymous growing up and when this spiritual transformation they talk about actually began. And I reflected on my life from the time I was a little boy, 5, 6, 7. I remember my mom having little birthday parties for me. It was the worst idea in the whole world. People were going to come and give me attention. And I would literally hide under the table when they would sing happy birthday. I'd run out. I'd make out I got lost. I'd do just strange things just because I didn't want that attention. And I would hear other kids talking about moms and dads throwing them a party or going to day camp in the summertime, summer camp, and doing things like that. I played Little League baseball, and that was enough. The idea of growing up and doing grown-up things or teenage things, it sounded pretty good. Getting a driver's license, dating, you know, going on vacation, making money. This sounds good. But you guys don't understand. My name is Peter Marinelli. There's no way I'm going to be able to do this. I am going to screw this up royally, so let's get out now. When I was 14, I discovered booze, and I didn't care anymore. So it was awful. I wanted out, and twice on the journey to hell, when I was in the grip of the grapes, I intentionally tried to die. I tried to take my life. And God interrupted my death both times, and he has me here today. That's why I do not question God's will for me anymore. I always question mine, though. When I was growing up, I had a mom who was one of us. She was sick and suffering alcoholic and was also addicted to what they called back then Mother's Little Helper, which were Valium. They were big back then in the 60s. And they gave my mom Valium not to drink, and like a real alky, we do both. We really do. I'm not kidding. I'm serious about this. I watched my mom suffer the humiliation, degradation that we go through. And for her, it had to be 100 times worse because she couldn't be a mom to me and my brothers. A lot of shame and guilt attached to that, I'm sure. She couldn't be a husband to my dad. She just couldn't be a woman with dignity. And she was suffering at the hands of alcoholism. And what this woman tried to do a few times was take a life. And in between that, I was the oldest brother and the oldest son and the firstborn. So my job was to caretake and pick her up and clean her up before dad got home. And I would hide pills and I would hide the booze and lie for her because that's what you do. Because mom is mom. And dad would ask me, was mom drinking today? Did mom take those little yellow pills or whatever? else she was doing, and I would say, no, you know, what do you do? And then one morning on January 23rd, about 1972-73, we all came to in terror and bewilderment, frustration and despair, and I was stricken with fear. If anyone's ever been frozen, but you can literally can't move because of fear, that's what happened to me. We woke up and mom finally succeeded in taking a life. So I walk with this. The first time I went to a funeral was hers, and I walked in, the first thought, this wonderful predator called the thinking mind said, it's your fault, you should have told dad about the drinking and the pills. You should have stopped this. And I couldn't. So I walk with this awful feeling, and then one summer, spring summer day, my friends are drinking cold 45 beer, and I kept thinking, if I drink with them, all I wanted, what they have to offer, something bad was going to happen to me, like me losing my voice. Some of you guys are happy, I know, don't worry. So I put my hand in, and I took a few pops of this quart of cold 45 beer, and it went down, and nothing happened, and I drank a little bit more, and I drank a little bit more, and then something happened as I continued to drink cold 45 beer. And the first thing I noticed was I start to feel a little bit happier. I start to feel warm. I start to get a little swagger. And my shoulders got wider. I got taller and better looking. I had hair on my chest by the end of the night. I wanted to be Al Pacino by midnight. I was able to talk to the girls. Up until that point, that was not happening. I remember growing up with a little bit of a stutter. You know, I used to change my name from Peter to Nick. I used to think my parents should have done a better job. Peter, what's your name? Peter. You know, Nick, I felt tough behind that. When I drank cold 45 beer, I didn't care what, you call me anything. I was able to talk to the girls, rough house with the guys. I got taller, I had muscles, I felt good. The beer muscles we get, the false courage we get. The other thing was, I was present to the moment. I wasn't thinking about that horrific pain of losing my mom. I wasn't afraid of this cunning, baffling, and powerful guy. I called him Dad. Right? I wasn't afraid about anything. I wasn't fearful. I was present to the moment. I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Alcohol was not a problem. Alcohol was a solution to my bedevilments. It was a panacea for what was killing me. Alcohol worked. I graduated from beer to liquor, but it still worked. It was not a problem. I didn't know, as Bill says in his story, it was going to turn in its flight like a boomerang and cut me to ribbons. Who knew about this stuff? Didn't know about obsession of the mind. It's foreign language. I never heard of these words before. Phenomenon called craving. I don't know what that means. Abnormal reaction. I don't know what that means. And God knows what a spiritual malady is. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just felt like I landed from another planet. You got it wrong, and I'm right. Somebody, please listen to me. Fear-based and insecure. If I was hanging out with you and says, Peter, you're a good guy, I'd go home with you. I'd follow you all over. Just somebody thinks I'm not that bad because deep within, no matter what you told me, deep within, I walked around with shame and guilt just for breathing. And the only thing that's going to remedy that back then for a while was booze. I remember reading something in a magazine, one of these magazines about what we suffer from. And they were talking how the alcoholic and the heroin, the opiate person, has some similar brain things that go, chemistry that goes on. And only the power of alcohol would shut down this deep inner rage that we walk with. Only the power of an opiate or alcohol would shut down this deep inner rage that we walk with. And I identified with that. Fear-based and insecure, and I wanted to scream at everyone. Right? But I wasn't worthy enough to scream, so keep my mouth shut and keep moving. Alcohol removed all that. I love the effect produced by alcohol. The first night I got loaded, by the way, I didn't break out into a street fight. I didn't wind up in a prison. I didn't have, you know, violence with anyone. I didn't have an argument with the wife or the girlfriend. I didn't black out. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. It was great. And when I went home, I slept great, and I got up the next morning and felt great. It was good. There were no hangovers. I wasn't vomiting. It was a good deal. No black eyes. My teeth were still in my mouth. Everything was pretty good. Go down to the park to play ball. And when I walked into the park, I felt really good about me. Like I said, I had a little bit of a swagger. My shoulders were that wide. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. And underneath that, I had this panacea for my illness. I can deal with the rest of the week right now. Because next Saturday, I'm drinking. I'm going to capture that elusive feeling once more. I'm going to love get there again. I'm going to love to get there one more time, and I can deal with the rest of the week. So the following Saturday, I rolled around, and I drank. I didn't know I stepped onto a road paved to hell. It was called alcoholism. I just knew when I drank, I wasn't thinking about Dad, Mom, or anything else. It made me feel good. What I've learned in AA on this side of the archway, if it feels good, doesn't mean it's good, and if it feels bad, it doesn't mean it's bad. A lot of things that made me feel good were short-lived and almost killed me. I don't even worship my emotions anymore, because some of us could do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We start to worship our emotions. I gotta feel good, gotta feel good. You're affecting my serenity, I have to feel good. I was in a meeting in Brooklyn, New York, and there was a drunk right off the street. He wasn't pretty, didn't smell nice, and was ugly. And a woman got up, she says, "He's affecting my serenity, I'm going to another meeting." What? I'm sorry, this is AA. Right? Go drink more tea when you're ready to come back. Right? So I don't worship my emotions, because they always get us in trouble, because those are always going up and down. And guess what? If you're living on page 52 and seeking recovery rather than getting recovered, you'll be worshiping your emotions every single day, and it's never right. We're always reaching out there to feel good inside, always looking for an external condition to be the remedy for the internal condition called alcoholism. We worship our emotions. We worship people, places, and things. They're going to do for me. They're going to give me a sense of okayness and togetherness inside, and we live a world of impermanence, and everything's changing. Rather than getting right with God, and it's always still, it's always right no matter what's going on, we walk through a storm, held head up high, shoulder squared, and recovered. Right? That's why I don't seek to be a recovering drunk anymore. I don't want to live like that. I start drinking on Saturdays, and it started to become Friday and Saturday, and then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I start to drink Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and when? Well, let's just drink. And I was drinking all the time, and as Bill says in his story, my drinking assumed more serious proportions. And there were many unhappy scenes in our home. We moved from Brooklyn, New York, to a place called Staten Island, New York, and that's when the trap door, I found out I had a trap door. Because I would come to in the morning, Bill says, when the terror and madness were upon him. Now I'm a young kid, just out of the starting gate with this drinking thing, drinking just a few years, and I'm starting to experience some consequences of my drinking, and so is my family. See, very often we'll hear, in some of our contemporary AA meetings, just don't drink and go to meetings. My amends is that I'm not drinking. I just have to put the plug in a jug and I'm a winner. I made a meeting and I'm a winner. No, no, you're not. Maybe not. Let's knock on the door and let's go ask mommy and daddy and wifey poo and the husband if just not drinking is enough. Let's go ask your employers, your former employees, if just not drinking is enough. We rip through the lives of others like tornadoes and leave damage and debris. So alcoholism was starting to twist me up pretty good. And guess what? My family was alone for the ride and they didn't even ask for it. I'm in the treatment center business and I get these men come in and the wife or mom and dad call me like they've been run over. They are so twisted up, these poor souls, and they don't know what to do. They think they can cure it. They think they cause it. They think they can control it. And I send them to another wonderful fellowship, and if any of you guys are here this morning, I thank you for Al-Anon and all the great works you guys are doing there. But I see what goes on with the families of alcoholics. It's awful. Just don't drink, go to meetings, does not pay the bill. And we are AA so much more than that. If it was just don't drink, go to meetings, the big book would have one page. Don't drink, go to meetings. See ya. My big book tells me years of living with an alcoholic will make any wife or child neurotic. The whole family, to some extent, is ill. Right? By the time God separated me in 1988 from alcoholism, from alcohol, my family was suffering from full-blown alcoholism, and none of them are drinkers. I mean, they're social drinker. So my drinking assumed more serious proportions, and I would wake up in the morning needing money to go drink, and what I did, well, like a good coward, was I would steal from my family. I would steal money from my kid brothers. I would steal money from my dad. And one morning I woke up and discovered my dad's checkbook, and I had this great idea. I'll forge his name on the check, the last check in the checkbook, so I won't notice the serial numbers, right? Had it all planned out, and I wrote out a check for 40 bucks or whatever it was, went down to the local store. They all knew my dad. How's your dad? Tell him I said hello. Anything for Victor, son. Sure. Here it is, and I go to the back of the store and get beer, and they give me that look. What are you doing? And they didn't ask questions. Do I go to a liquor store and get some liquor? And I did this for a little bit of time, so I thought I hit the lottery. How great is this? But I was like a rebel without a clue, because I didn't know anything about checking statements. See, that stuff. So my dad is a guy who makes Tony Soprano look like Tinkerbell. I mean, when he came looking for me and the word was out, your dad's looking for you, I was looking for a boat to China. I was out. And so I didn't come home. And I was sitting in downtown Manhattan with this girlfriend. And I got drunk with her. She was my girlfriend. And when we're getting drunk, we swear she's Bo Derek. She's beautiful. Bo Derek. I met the girl in my dreams. We wake up next to Bo Diddley. You want to hang out? So I'm in love, right? And I told the love of my life when my dad drove up and jumped out of the car and screamed my name. His deportment shouted. He was an angry man. My dad's a man's man. He's a street guy. You know, those tough guys you see on TV. Nothing bothers him. And he's the only type of guy who goes to a fight in new suede shoes and a pinky ring. Right? That's how he goes to a fight. So he jumped out of the car and screamed my name. And I told her, that's my dad. You talk to him. I'm leaving. And I ran away, and then he caught me, and I went to my first treatment center, and I did 28 days in treatment. Now, I don't know about up here, but down in the States back in the day, Blue Cross Blue Shield is a big insurance provider. I'll get on a soapbox here. They would say, 27 days, you can't go home. You're not ready. 29 days is way too long, but on 28 day, you're good to go home. And for 28 days, they gave me charts and graphs on what alcoholism is and all these little... By the time they got done telling me about charts and graphs, my dysfunctional family, my enablers and my triggers, I needed a double. I'm really in trouble, right? And so off I went after 28 days, and I had that young lady meet me at the door. I says, honey, I'm coming home. I was at a real fancy place in a town, Long Island, New York. Right? And I treated like I was coming home from some federal prison. I said, honey, I'm coming home. Bring a jug. They told me to go to AA meetings. I inquired about AA, cracked the seal, booze went down, we got drunk. I got drunker because I was alcoholic and she wasn't. I couldn't stop. The phenomenon called craving was just interrupted because I was going through detox in 28 days of treatment. The mental obsession never left. The mental obsession will not leave unless we get some sort of spiritual transformation. And there's a difference with the spiritual experience. Watching a baby being born, that can be a spiritual experience. Watching the sun rise or set, that can be a spiritual experience. Watching certain things happen in our lives, oh my God, overwhelmed by God. That's a spiritual experience, not what they're talking about in the big book, which is life-changing, life-transforming. Because after the baby is born or after the sun rises and set, we go back to our business. We still go back to drink. I watched my kid get born this morning. Oh my God, give me a drink. Right? The life transformation that they're talking about in the big book, the spiritual transformation, spiritual revolution, spiritual awakening, is different. And that requires the death of self, the removal of self before the actual physical death. And that is where rubber hits the road and many of us bail. But it's something that is absolutely required in order for people like us to get to the other side and pass through the archway, free men and women at last. And that's the message we ought to be offering in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and not just put the plug in the jug. So I went right back to the same vicious cycle. There was no spiritual remedy. I did 28 days in treatment. I went to gym class, physical fitness, and do all the things they told me to do. Didn't concede to my innermost self I was an alkie. I went away because my dad threatened my life. You're going away to treatment. I found out about what you're up against. You're not going to turn out to be like mom. He was trying to care for his older son. I hated my dad before I got sober. He was always on me, leave me alone. I realized what he was dealing with, trying to save someone's life. He did the best he could with what he had. My best friend in the whole world today. So I get out of treatment, I'm right back to the same vicious cycle again. How can I deal with a solution? How can I hear a solution? How can I be teachable if I still have a reservation or a lurking notion? When I was in this treatment center, it was a pretty funny deal one day. They take us to a gym about this size. A basketball court on that side, a basketball court on this side, and we had the crackheads, we had the heroin guys, we had the drunks, we had the pill guys and the women, and we're all in the gym detoxing, well, you know, vibrating. Sick, right? And they say, we're going to play basketball. So I had these little seats that fold down and was sitting there. It was a sight. And the basketball rolled from one end of the gym to the other. And physical fitness, I swear, went just like this. I'm not getting it. You get it. Right. You want to have a smoke? Yeah, let's go. So outside smoking cigarettes, and that was physical fitness. So treatment didn't work. I'm in the treatment center business. I have the liberty to make fun of it, because there are some good things that go on. But back then, it was completely different. So I hit my second treatment center. And then I hit my third treatment center. And I got a job working with my dad. My whole family are longshoremen. They're dock workers. Anyone ever seen the movie On the Water from Marlon Brando? You know, that's kind of the environment. Not that raw, but that's the environment. A lot of rough characters in that environment. My dad had an impeccable reputation. I never saw my dad go to work in working boots. My dad went to work dressed because he was a shop steward or some sort of foreman. Right? Had a nice little, well, nice for the waterfront, an office. You know, a lot of strange characters walking in and out of there, some of the men. But he had about 500 men working for him. I looked at my dad as just like he was the general of an army. Never got his hands dirty. And then he hired me. And my dad always told me, keep your head up. No matter what's going on, you keep your head up. Don't let anyone see what's going on. That's the rules we learn. Never give up anything. Even if you're scared to death, you look him in the eye. That's how my father operated. By the time God separated me in 1988 from booze, my dad looked like one of us when we first walked in here. He was hunched over. He was looking at his shoes all the time. His wrinkles. He was underweight, he was sick, and my two brothers, who were big, strappy guys, looked the same. My family walked like alcoholics because that's what owned them. That's why I don't come to meetings. I hope I never share from a podium like this or go share from our sacred AA, especially to a newcomer. All you have to do today is not drink and you're a winner, because that's a lie. That's a lie. And it shortchanges the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and what God can do for people like us and them. Because what we get in AA, if no one's told you this, let me be the first one. If it ruffles feathers, tough. What we get to do in AA, we get great power, no longer powerless. God removes the drink problem. Step 10 promises, talk about that. And if that, you have contempt prior to investigation to go through the work and experience it and come back and shout that from the rooftops as well. The drink problem's been removed, placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. God's taking care of that. And what's replaced with that is a tremendous amount of power. We get power not only to touch the lives of people in AA and get them well, but heal. We get the power to heal others in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that sounds like some evangelical thing on TV. That's not what I'm talking about. But if you think about it, think of the condition of our families before we recovered. How many 12-step calls have we gone on and gone into that family's house and the family is sick and suffering? And you take that drunk, you take him or her and wake them up via the 12 steps and they get right with God and they make restitution and they make amends and do all the things we're supposed to do by living in all three sides of the triangle, go back into that home. It's different. She's different, he's different, the kids are different, the drunk is different, everything's different, work is better, maybe a new career, and they've reconciled, and together, shoulder to shoulder, they're walking together again. I've seen it a million times. We get the power to heal. Where did that come from? A meeting of AA. And it could be some ugly church based on some Park Avenue fancy meeting in New York. Doesn't make a difference. God is God. Right? But how come in meetings of AA we keep God under the table or we keep him in the back room? Oh, he's new. Don't talk about God yet. Why? Why do we do that when we've got a lot of us who are dying? And it is only a newcomer. It's those of us sitting around here with double digits wondering, when the hell is this thing going to get better? Because I'm getting really thirsty. And if anyone saw my private life, I'd be mortified and you'd kick me out of AA. No need to do that anymore. So I watched my family, starting with my pop, just go down the tubes because of this thing called alcoholism. and he isn't an alcoholic. Right around my fifth treatment center, my dad was really at his wit's end. They thought a lunacy commission should be appointed for me. I went from, you know, dating the nice girls to dating someone as sick as me or worse. The running partners. And the quality of my friendships deteriorated, and then there were no friendships, and my family's wondering, what are we gonna do with this guy? I come from an Italian-American family. I'm the firstborn. Great expectations here. It was either Pope or President. I made it to AA. We're at a Thanksgiving gathering one time. My youngest brother is an actor. And my middle brother is a big partner in some fancy European bank. Always a white-collar kid, straight kid. And we're at this thing, and my grandmother has all her friends over for Thanksgiving celebration. And she says, this is my youngest grandson. He's a movie star. This is my other grandson, he owns a bank. And this is my firstborn grandson, he talks to drug addicts. That's my introduction. Where was I? I was getting drunk somewhere. My dad decides at one point that what I need to fix this thing is a woman, a good woman. You need a good woman back in your life. You need to get married, you need to have kids, you need to get your job back. Because I was working as a longshoreman, impossible to get fired from. My dad threw me out, said, don't come back here anymore. I was borrowing money from people that I shouldn't even be in the same area code with. They were looking for me. So I got blackballed from the waterfront, do not come back. And my dad said, what I'm going to do is give you this apartment. I want you to look, I want you to meet a nice girl. Get dressed nice, he bought me clothes, bought me new shoes, bought me a color TV, all the things you would need to kind of get going, get on your feet, if you're not an alcoholic or an addict. And the first thing I thought, that's a nice color TV, I'll probably get about 50 bucks for it as soon as it leaves. No human power could relieve me of my alcoholism. I didn't know that, nor did he. They were just banking on something. Grab the brass ring, something to pull you out of this. And when my dad left, I took the color TV, the shoes and boxes, the clothes and garment bags, the whole place, little by slowly started to get sold out on the street, along with not paying rent. Almost burned the place down. I used to borrow money from the landlord to not pay him back. And what happened, as you would expect, I got thrown out. And I was unemployable. I have a nice little apartment now. I live across the street from the beach. I live in South Florida. I'm in love in South Florida. It's beautiful. But I live like someone who's recovered, one of us. Back then I had a bed, a mattress that was soiled and bloodstained. And there was no comforter. There were no sheets. There was an old pillow. When I slept, I would basically just, you know, you pass out. And then you come to. I would get little cat naps. And there were Mr. Boston Blackberry brandy bottles now, all over, and some Jack Daniels bottles. And there were some other things I got addicted to floating around. And I wasn't bathing, and laundry was all over. It looked like a hellhole. All kind of strange characters screaming my name in the middle of the night to see if I was home. And I got thrown out of this place, and I lived on the street for a short time, panhandled. And I, really, by God's grace, I got into my sixth treatment center and I signed myself out after a day and a half. I had people pleading with me, these counselors, don't leave, you're going to die, you're going to drink and die. But the obsession to drink alcohol, as you know, would pull me through a crack in a wall. And they would talk to me about God's grace, God's grace, God's grace. I would hear God's grace in AA too, I still do, which is a great thing. It's like feeding our children, not expecting the kid to say thank you. My children are hungry, I feed them, I'll give them my own food. I will go hungry for my children. God's grace. Just for being one of his children, it's this gift we get. But there is a difference between God's grace and spiritual fitness. And sometimes in our meetings, we forget that. There's some work. Vision for you says patience, willingness, and labor. Labor, last I checked, I had to get my hands in the mud, get a little dirty, and God will do the growing. So I signed myself out of my sixth treatment center, and I'm homeless. And trap doors have trap doors, and I don't know where I was going, but I had to get out of treatment. I was notorious for bad detoxes. I couldn't even fathom the idea that I'm going to go through this detox again, and I'm going to be sick again, and I'm, you know, rocking and rolling, and the insanity is coming back. You need another drink, and all the remorse and guilt is screaming at me. You know what we do when we're like that. I need a drink just to breathe right now. And they're telling me about, well, it'll get better, to hang in there, and you need to go to AA. I need now. Now, I need relief right now. And the only thing I know is going to give me instant relief and put me there is a Mr. Boston Blackberry brandy. Because when I romance it, when it goes down, it's going to hit my gut and I can breathe. Okay, what do we got? Dysfunctional family, that's a topic I'll start. You know. Not happening. So I signed myself out. And I left this hospital in Long Island, panhandled all thumbed my ride all the way back from Long Island down to downtown Brooklyn, panhandling the streets, came up with enough money to run to the liquor store, get a jug. And I washed the night away in the back of a filthy hallway, and that's how I lived. I'm the type of drunk, folks, suit and all. If I was to, God forbid, drink this afternoon, tonight or tomorrow morning, you're pulling me out of a dumpster. I blow up quick. I don't have a gradual decline. I'm grateful for the bottoms. It was the gift of desperation that keeps me here 23 years later, seeking this power, the desperation of a drowning man. And in that seeking this power, and not trying to start the spiritual process with an answer, as a lot of us do, just anything is better than what I had. It got me to go on a little bit of a journey with this power called God. Lots of different ideas about God, a lot of conceptions about God, what God is, what God isn't, God is here, God is there. And I found out what our big book says, the great reality is deep down within, which means the Spirit of God is in you and in you, including the drunk drinking of the River Bridge right now. The only thing is difference is I got a program, they don't, they may be my sponsor in 90 days. That there is only one power. And I don't want to step on anyone's toes. I'm not telling anyone how to believe, but just a consideration. Sometimes I used to walk with this two powers. This power called God who's going to go to fight with this other power, this lower power, this evil power, or alcoholism. My power is going to go fight this power. Guess what? I'm always in fear, aren't I? Because that power just might win. I'm always living a life of fear. What if God doesn't work? What if I get a little agnostic? What if this power's a little stronger that day? What if he had his Wheaties and he might win? Oh my God, I'm in fear. I'm always walking with fear. The reality is there is only one power, and there is not even duality in my life anymore. You're from Toronto, I'm from Brooklyn. Big deal. We're children of God. We're connected. No separateness. The same thing we are, we're connected with God. No separateness. Is there a God in the heavens? I'll find out when he calls me home. But for now, I know the great reality is right here, and that's where my work is. As a messenger of God, I come to serve, not to be served, and I can't let differences get in the way. When I recognize and awaken to in the realization of that you have as much God in you as I do, and we're connected, life gets easy. I wear the world like a loose garment. I don't care what you believe. You walk up, you go up the hill with a polka dot donkey, I go up with a striped donkey, she has a black one, he's got a, who cares? We're going to the same place anyway. Let's not be warring theologians in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't read the big book, I do. Maybe I can help you, maybe you can help me. I will challenge you, you'll challenge me. But let's not go to war over it. See, when I start to fight with you, I become guilty of what I'm accusing you of all along. So I meet resistance with no resistance. What would the Father want me to do right now? You're coming at me, me and my big book can go to hell. Okay, great, that's fine. That's fine. I'm still here. I'm still your friend. Maybe I can learn something from you. Maybe you need to bop to your drop a little bit more and come back to you and say, hey, you know what? I may have had this wrong. Can you help me? If I'm angry with you, how can I help you? It's become a personal thing. That's not what God has for us. That's not spiritual living. That's not getting the spiritual wings and going to do God's work and going to trenches. I need to be working with someone who just spat on me, someone who just cursed me, and they come back and say, can you sponsor me? Let's go. I stand at that door. Great quote, forgive them for they know not what they do. Meet resistance with no resistance. I wind up outside the Midtown Manhattan Port Authority. Anyone's been to Manhattan, Midtown Port Authority, 9th Avenue side of the Port Authority, not a good place, especially back in the 80s. And there I am. And I don't know how I got there. I don't know what happened to me afterwards, but I've shared this story from a million of these podiums because it was the mustard seed that began, the flimsy reed our book talks about, I should say, that proves to be the loving and powerful hand of God. Bill talks about King Alcohol, uses the words bitter morass of self-pity. right? Quicksand stretched around them in all directions. I so identify with that. Because there I was in, outside the Port Authority, and I had this moment of clarity. We get struck sober, no matter how blind drunk we are, no matter what we're doing. We all get to a place where, oh my God, what happened? What is going on here? And we could be in the middle of a fight with our spouse or the children, whatever it might be, on the way to liquor store, and something is like, what the hell am I doing with my life? What is this? How did this happen, which is what happened to me? And I thought of my whole life kind of flashed before me in a sense. My mom, who died years prior, my dad and my kid brothers who were so close to me, I don't even know where they are anymore. They don't know where I am. And my whole life, it was a big mistake. And there I am standing on 9th Avenue side of Port Authority, filthy, drinking myself literally to death. If I live to be 100, I'll never be as old as the day I walked into AA in 1988. And what I did in this moment of clarity where God was saying, now hold on, I bit the hand that was about to feed me and I says, it's your fault. I despise this power called God. I hated God. You're a trickster. You're a jokester. You're playing some kind of game up there with my life, and he or she or it got all of it. But God meets me with no resistance. And I can curse God all I want. I can call God out. I tell new people, call God out. God doesn't judge. In fact, I go to God for forgiveness, like a student going to a teacher or a son going to his father. Please forgive me for what I've done. I've made a mistake, which is a wonderful thing, an act of humility. God never got angry, though. God doesn't have to waste time forgiving. If it makes you feel better, you're forgiven. Go ahead, go. Right. All love, no opposite. My Heavenly Father never gets angry, but always wanting to assist, always wanting to push, and sometimes grab us by the throat and say, no, you got to go here. But all love and no opposite. I wound up outside in the back of another hallway. It was June 23rd, 1988. It was hot like this. I was walking around with a turtleneck, some dirty old jacket. I had a jug of Mr. Boston, and I had blood-stained soiled pants on and construction boots with holes in them. I looked like someone who was living in the hallway on a Bowery, one of these missions. It was really in sad shape. And I couldn't do it. I was done. And the same power that I had cursed just a short while before that, I don't know if it was a week, 2 weeks, I have no recollection of that time. But that same power I cursed, I begged June 23rd, 1988, if you're out there, I called them out, take me from this. I don't want to die. And what God does is when the heart is pure like that and the intent is pure, the motives have ceased, God will kick open the door and come get us. Because one of his children are in trouble. Any of us who have children, they can be challenging. We were talking about that earlier. But if any of us have children, nieces or nephews, no matter how angry you are at them, and you hear them say, please come help me, we're there. We'll settle it later. We're there. You can't explain that bond. So I don't try to explain the bond of God, but you know what I'm talking about, because none of us would be here if we didn't experience that great love. And I said, please take me from this. There's a God I had cursed and spit at and everything, blamed all the time. I don't know, he was used to it, because we've all done it. And the words I got were, enough, I have other work for you to do, as if someone whispered it in my ear, and I thought I had completely lost my mind. And what I found out later on was, I did lose my mind. When I'm out of my mind, it's the only place I can experience God. When we're in our mind, that's the problem. You hear newcomers, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing it. I must be out of my mind. I tell them, no, if you're out of your mind, you'd be hitting a home run. You're in your mind, that's why you keep screwing up. Get out of your mind. Lose your mind to find God. And in that moment, I went from resistance, which is all in the mind, to no resistance and true liberation, freedom, surrender, which is in the spirit. I was out of my mind. There was no thinking, if you're out there, please take me from this. No thought like, if I get sober, she'll love me again. If I get sober, I might get my job back. If I get sober, I'm going to get a big book and be an AA guru. I don't want to die. That's it. As raw and honest as I can be. And God connected the dots. He will connect the dots for us when we don't have the power to know how to do so. This is the infinite power and mercy and love of a God that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous with no conditions. We put conditions on love. Honey, I love you unconditionally on the condition you meet all my conditions. If not, I'm calling my lawyer. Right? no conditions on this deal with God. God's got our back. There is no gravity in God's world. Even when opportunity, what appear to be opportunities, get removed, they're actually directions on which way I'm supposed to go. Oh, this opportunity is removed. No, it wasn't God saying, go here. My dad was south, about 4 hours in Atlantic City. I'm in the back of this filthy hallway begging this power to save me, to take me from this. And the words I get were, enough, I have other work for you to do. Only recently, a handful of years ago, I know what that means. My dad gets that intuitive thought, tells his wife, my son's in trouble. My kid Peter's in trouble. I need to go look for him. He dropped her off and went through the streets. 4 hours. From Atlantic City, New Jersey, up to Brooklyn, driving through the streets as God would have it. He finds me. Gets out of the car, but he didn't scream my name like he did when I stole from him. He called my name, and I forget it. And it was almost like this voice, this very fragile voice, but a strong voice. He hadn't seen his son. He was trying to find his son. He finally called my name. He wanted to take care of me. And he walked across the street. My dad has a way, his whole deportment can be intimidating, but he wasn't intimidating that day. He had a gentle spirit with him, but not gentle to the point where I would run circles around it. God had my dad meet me where I am. God works through people. It could be a policeman, an employer, a son, a daughter, whatever it might be, but God uses certain people to say, go meet them. Go meet him, go meet her, and will give us the right deportment, the right words, everything to meet that drunk the way we meet them when they come in here. We know the drunk is full of shame and guilt and remorse and all of that. But we don't use that as a weapon. Well, I got 10 years. No, we get right down there with them. Welcome. What do we always say? Welcome. This is Mary, this is John, this is Frank, this is... Sit with us. Welcome. No matter what they look like, what they smell like, welcome. Because we all have been there. God gives us at least that much in here without even the steps to say, welcome. We know where you are. We get where they are. This is the great thing about sacred AA. And God will give that to other people, whether they may bark a little bit or be gentle. It's to get us where we are. And my dad walked across the street, called my name. And I said, Dad, I'm okay. Everything's good. And then I collapsed. And my dad held me up. And this, I always like to share this story because if it feels good, doesn't mean it's good. If it feels bad, doesn't mean it's bad. I'm always interpreting the world through this mind. And here we are, the two of us, standing in the worst moment of our life. My dad's oldest son is disintegrating in front of him. Doesn't even know if I'm going to live. Doesn't even know if this is gonna, another treatment center is going to work. This thing, AA, he went to, failed. I'm about 130 pounds. Right? I hadn't bathed, I don't know how long. My dad's holding me up, patting me on the back, saying, I'm not going to lose my son to this. I'm not going to lose my son to this. Make this mantra. In the worst moment of our lives, our roots were grasping new soil already. The spiritual awakening was beginning. Because God gave me in the back of that hallway, June 23rd, 1988, mustard seed of willingness. And on that, we can move a mountain. And connected the dots quickly. No time to hang around. Let's connect the dots. Get Dad, bring him to a hospital. Let's go, and AA will take over. Connect the dots. And I knew, I was very mindful that my dad is holding me. It took this for this to happen. I felt like a 10-year-old kid protected by his dad. I'm a grown up, 28 years old, I guess, 27, 28, getting sober. But for that moment, I was this little kid being protected by Vic, by my dad. I was fearless for a moment and dying at the same time. And so off I went to my 7 treatment center and 10 days in this place, same place, Long Island, the insidious insanity, the first drink, telling me go drink. And they sent me to Minnesota. I didn't drink. And I was around people in Alcoholics Anonymous who got to the podium and talking about living in all three sides of the triangle. They talked about the 12 steps. They talked about a God. They talked about service and this glorious fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they looked the part. And they would invite me into their homes, and they would invite me to the diner, and they would invite me into their lives. And a couple of them worked with me and gave me some AA tapes at the time. I wanted what you guys had to offer for the first time in my life. There was a meeting called the Three Legacies meeting. Scared the hell out of me. When I walked in, it was 3 times the size of this. Everyone was dressed, and the speakers got to the podium dressed like I am now. And women wore suits. It looked great. I came home from Minnesota, and it was almost 11 months, and my first appointed teacher showed up, and we began a journey through the Big Book again, and my life has never been the same. On this path, we can outgrow our teachers, our sponsors, if they're not growing and understanding effectiveness. My life is about growing and understanding effectiveness, and Mark H. was my new sponsor, and we started reworking the steps regularly. Reworking the steps regularly, having a life of prayer and meditation. I sit in sacred silence 3 times a day. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor a bunch of men. I do nightly review. I'm accountable, responsible, and I'm consistent with all that I do, all coming from the Father, not from me, because I still go to my Heavenly Father and thank Him. Thank you, Father, for the willingness to go to any lens today, not let it come from me, but it's consistent when it comes through God. 22 years later, I'm still doing that. Thank the good Lord for that. So I stand at the door. I stand on the firing line. I don't have a life. That sounds lame to some new folks, but I don't have a life. Ask some of the old timers been through the book. They know what I'm talking about. They'll tell you what I mean. I don't have a life. It belongs to my Heavenly Father and this sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have it any other way. That's all I got. Peace.